You know how good it feels when somebody does something nice for you? Just for no reason at all other than to show you, you know, to express their affection towards you, the fact that they just want to bless you and do something nice for you. I made the mistake in our first church back just over 20 years ago. I mentioned just in passing one Sunday how much I like peanut butter cookies. Well, that was like 40 pounds ago, because from that day forward, you know, not just birthdays and anniversaries and Christmas and, you know, Easter and whatever, but I mean it seemed like almost every week some dear soul was bringing me in a giant bag of peanut butter cookies. Here, Pastor, I know you like these cookies. And I'm going, oh, I can't, you know. So for the record, I'm all done with peanut butter cookies, but you can appreciate, well, unless they're really good, then, you know, the door's still open. But you can appreciate, well, never mind. I ate a whole bag of them once. I guess that's the bottom line. And maybe that's why I don't need any more. But you know how good that feels? Somebody just appreciates you. They love you. They like you. They know, you know, of something that you enjoy. And so they go out of their way for no particular reason. It's not a thank you for a favor you did. It's just they just want to bless you. That's a great thing. You know, that's in the Bible sense, that's what we see in John chapter 12. And the word that comes up is devotion. You know, an act of devotion. And the dictionary defines devotion as profound dedication. Profound dedication. And in a Christian sense, it further defines it as the ready will to serve God. And the first few verses here of John 12 describe not just one, but actually two acts of devotion. So we're going to read these first 11 verses. Before we read them, maybe give you something to look for. Warren Wiersbe, in his commentary on John, kind of breaks this section down into work, worship, and witness. Now, I'm not going to borrow Wiersbe's outline for the body of our lesson, but as you read through this now, look for work, worship, and witness. So here we are in John chapter 12, reading from my New English Standard Version Bible. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Now remember, we studied that whole chapter last week. And if you weren't here, you can get the DVD or what do they call it? Not tapes anymore. CD, thank you. I got to keep up with all this new lingo. So they gave a dinner for him there. Martha served, that's the older sister. Lazarus was one of those reclining with him at the table. Mary, therefore, took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" And he said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. And having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. And Jesus said, "Leave her alone, so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you don't always have me." And when the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he'd raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. Okay. Did you see it in there? Work, worship, witness. I'll point it out to you as we go through it verse by verse here. First thing I want you to take note of from this passage is that devotion is expressed in many ways. There's not just one way to show devotion, just like there's not just one way to worship. There's many ways to express devotion. In fact, just about anything you can do can be an act of devotion, if it comes from a heartfelt desire to bless God without any thought of compensation. For example, there are those who express their devotion by serving the Lord. Now, we have a whole lot of those here throughout the week, but what comes to mind to me are the people that come and serve and prepare for this Sunday service each week. I mean, there are people who come and make sure the pencils are sharp and the papers are in the pews, the visitor cards and the note cards. There are people that, you know, come and clean the church, vacuum and dust, and there are people who come early and make the coffee and get the cookies out, and there's a group that comes early to pray for the service. In fact, I would love to take this opportunity to invite any and all of you to come early and be a part of that prayer. It's not, you know, it's open to whosoever will. It's not a closed group. But there are all these people that do so many things just to get ready. And the praise team comes early to practice the music so that we're ready to go. And there's just a lot of people that serve the Lord in a lot of ways. You know, they're the first ones here. They're the last to leave. You know, you might think they're serving you. And in a sense, they are. The chairs are set up, the coffee's out, everything, you know, the lights are on, the sound system is turned on and tested, and, you know, there's a lot of preparation that goes in. You might think they're serving you. In a sense, I guess you could say they're serving me only insofar as if they don't do it, I have to. I have to turn the lights on, turn the sound system on. If nobody made the coffee, guess who? I'd do it. You could say that they're serving me, and that sometimes I feel obligated to thank them, you know, for holding up that end of the deal. But really, they're not serving you and they're not serving me. They're serving the Lord. And that applies, you know, down to Sunday school teachers, Bible study leaders, home group leaders. I mean, that's just how those people express their devotion. One way they express their devotion is by serving here at church. You know, serving the Lord is always a wonderful way of expressing devotion to the Lord. Look at Martha in verse 2. They gave a dinner for him, for Jesus, and Martha served. And for you, for according to the, you know, the Wearsby outline, this is where we see devotion expressed through work. Martha. Now, Martha often gets a bad rap, you know, because she, some would say, or sometimes we get the impression that she maybe was concerned about unimportant things. You know, there's that occasion where Jesus comes to the house and Lazarus isn't mentioned, I don't think, but Mary is there at his feet listening to him teach, you know, and Martha's in the kitchen and she's cooking and cleaning and whipping up a feast for this surprise crowd that came to visit, and she's ticked. You know the story. She comes out and says, "Why is my sister just get to sit here, you know, and enjoy this, and I have to be in there toiling and slaving away, you know?" And Jesus, he says, "Well, Martha, you know, actually Mary made the better choice." But that doesn't mean that what Martha was doing wasn't important, and it doesn't mean that what Martha was doing wasn't appreciated. He's just making the point that, you know, if you have the option to sit at the teacher's feet, that might be the, you know, the best choice. Remember, Jesus had just fed thousands with a, you know, a couple of fish and a little bit of bread. He could probably handle the household if it came down to it. But we get this idea about Martha, how she's just so busy. You know, "Martha, Martha, you're concerned about many things, but one thing is important." And that's true. But don't let that give her a bad rap. Jesus said, words in red in Matthew 23:11, "He who is great among you shall be your servant." So who was the greatest in the house that day in that sense? Really, it's Martha serving the Lord with her work. And I said it before, anything you do can be an act of devotion. It might be serving the Lord directly, like a Martha. Or it might be providing for the Lord or the needs of his people. You know, rather than working, it's just that providing for the needs. And of course, the most obvious example of that is giving. Remember the story from Luke chapter 21, where Jesus is standing back and he's watching people put money in the treasury. It's a brass metal, you know, horn-shaped thing, kind of a funnel. and you come by, and as you put your coins in, it makes a big racket. And so the people who wanted to look good in front of the crowd would come by with a whole bag of coins and clang, ka-clang, ka-clang, and it would echo around, and they would look to make sure everybody noticed. And then this little old lady, a widow, comes up, and she has a coin called a mite. It's worth about a tenth of a penny. Or at least it used to be. It's probably worth a hundredth of a penny in today's economy, but it ain't worth much. But she comes up and you can just hear it. Tink. And Jesus looks at his followers and he says, you know what? She gave more than all these people. And you can be, what? You know, did we not see the money bag? And no, she gave more than all these people because she didn't give out of her excess. She didn't give her extra money. She gave her only money. She gave more than all those people, that little hundredth or tenth of a point. See, it's not the value, the monetary value of the gift. It's the devotion with which it's given that the Lord appreciates. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. It's important that you put your eyes on the words on the paper. God works through this in a supernatural way that doesn't happen if somebody just reads it out loud to you. And if you didn't bring a Bible, there should be a couple in front of you there. Okay, 2 Corinthians 9, verse 6. Whoever sows sparingly, you know, using the picture of someone sowing seed, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. And here's the verse. In fact, this is the verse that's etched on the offering box, which is out in the other room if you ever happen to look it up. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. You know, the point there is that the attitude counts more than the amount. Giving is an act of devotion. It's the devotion that counts more than the deed or the dollars involved. And by all means, don't get the idea that this is just about money. You know, in John chapter 19, you don't have to turn there. When we get to the end of the book in a couple of months from now, when Jesus is on the cross, you know, part of that horrible process is that they take all the clothes off of the victim, the subject of crucifixion. And Jesus, unlike most people, had this one-piece undergarment. Now realize how, or it's hard to realize how unusual that is. But someone, probably one of the women that followed him around, but someone had lovingly, carefully, you know, skillfully sewn together this one piece, you know, kind of outfit that probably slipped over the head, and there wasn't two pieces, and it wasn't tied together or buttoned or hooked. I mean, that's a big deal just culturally. That was uncommon. But just think about the person that made that. You know, my wife makes me stuff now and then. When we first met, she made me a couple of shirts. And I hope you don't mind me telling on you here, but she made this beautiful shirt. She picked out the fabric, and I think we picked out the pattern because it was a certain pattern that you couldn't just buy at the store. And she made this shirt, I mean, it, you know, laboring for hours on the sewing machine, following the pattern. Somehow, don't ask me, definitely don't ask her, somehow the shirt ended up with two left cuffs. Well, she was 14, you know, give her a break. But she gave me the shirt, and I put it on, and I buttoned one, and I buttoned the other, and I'm going, oh, the buttons are on their own. You know. But, man, I love that shirt. I wore that shirt until it fell off me. And if anybody said, what's wrong? What's the deal with that cuff there? I'd say, that's the way I like it. That's the way I want it. I had her make that specially for me just that way because... Oh, just that was, you know, that shirt was precious to me, and that garment was precious to Jesus. And think about the person that made it. Just pure devotion, love expressed outwardly, just because of who he was and who he was to them. You know, sowing, sharing, giving, serving, working, teaching, helping. One's no more or less valuable than the others. Devotion is expressed in many ways. Next thing we see here is that devotion doesn't count the cost. Verse 3. Mary therefore took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Can you just imagine that incredible thing? Now, we don't know maybe what that smells like exactly, but man, nard. You know what that word means? It means nard. That's all it means, nard. It's from the plant, the nardo starches plant, if that's how you pronounce it. You take the oil from that plant, you know, and you reduce it down, and it's expensive in this culture specifically. It grows only in East India, and they would refine that plant down to that oil and put it in a little flask, a little, in this case, an alabaster jar, you know, kind of like porcelain, and sealed up. You didn't just take a little now and then, you know, and do this. No, she's most likely, I mean, this thing costs a fortune, first of all. Let's get through that. Extremely expensive. It's pure. It's not watered down. It's not the cheap stuff. It's the real deal. In fact, in verse 5, we find out that this little flask of oil is worth 300 denarii. This is a year's pay. That puts it in a little different perspective, doesn't it? A year's pay, and most likely, the scripture doesn't say this, but most likely, this was her dowry. You kind of read between the lines here and realize that Mary and her sister Martha and her brother Lazarus had this household, you know, unmarried sisters being cared for by the older brother, and you kind of wonder where the folks are, and the safest assumption is they're just not around anymore. And she's saving this up as a dowry. You know, this is worth a year's pay, and the way the thing worked out there, actually, maybe we should go back to this, because, you know, when an unmarried girl was married, this year's worth of oil becomes the property, you know, of her husband that he can sell. A year's pay. I don't know what a year's pay is for you. I heard a great story once about there was a line to get into heaven. Now, this isn't how heaven really is, okay? This is just a story. And of course, St. Peter at the pearly gates, right? There's a line to get into heaven, and then one fellow steps up, and St. Peter says, how much money did you make last year? He says, that's an odd question, but I think I netted about, I don't know, 150, 175 grand. St. Peter says, corporate lawyer? Guy says, that's right. How'd you know? He says, well, you know, you get used to this after a couple millennium. And so he steps on through. The next guy steps up, and St. Peter says, how much money did you make last year? And the fellow says, well, I think I might have maybe grossed about $60,000. And he says, oh, you own your own small business? Guy says, that's right. How'd you know? St. Peter says, well, after a while, you kind of get used to how this works. Next guy steps up, kind of scraggly looking guy, long hair, beard, blue jeans. And St. Peter says, how much did you make last year? And the guy says, oh, man, I think I brought in about, maybe $5,000. St. Peter says, really? What do you play? A year's wages. So for you, is that $5,000? Is it $20,000? Is it $40,000? Is it $50,000? Is it $100,000? No matter what economy, you know, of scale that fits you personally, a year's wages is a lot. This is expensive stuff, and this is supposed to take her into, you know, her marriage. I mean, this is a big deal. Now, she wasn't saving it for a funeral, because if she was, she probably would have used it at her brother's funeral just a few days ago before Jesus, you know, resuscitated him, brought him back, said, you know, Lazarus, come forth, all that stuff that we went through last week. So not only is this expensive, but it's precious to her personally. Who knows how many years she's held on to this. Maybe it was a gift from her father. You know, just a precious thing. Yet she so loved Jesus and was so devoted to him that she broke it open. You know, there's no screwing the cap back on. She broke it open and used the whole thing to soothe his hot, dry, tired feet. Now, there's another gospel that says that she put it on his head. What most likely happened is that she put it on him from head to toe. The most precious thing she had in the world. You know, maybe you've heard this story. Della and Jim, not part of our fellowship, so don't look around. But Della and Jim, they were poor. They were struggling to get by, but boy, were they in love. You know, he was the light of her life, and she was the sunshine, you know, in his day and all that kind of stuff, mushy, gooey, you know. And Della was known for her beautiful, long, you know, waist length or longer hair. Beautiful hair. And then, of course, Jim was known because he had this incredible gold watch that was he got from his father, who got it from his father, and he liked to pull this thing out, and it kept perfect time, and it wasn't scratched. You know, it was an antique in perfect working order, worth a fortune, and he was just so thrilled to have it. Well, one Christmas Eve, you know, they're trying to think of how they can provide for one another. So Della found a place, went out, and sold her hair. You know, the pride of her life, the thing she was known for, the thing her husband loved, and had her hair cut short and sold that hair so she could use the money to get her husband a gift. The husband, Jim, went down to the local loan place and sold that gold watch just to get enough money to buy Della a gift that he felt would express just how much he cared for her. And then they get up the next morning and it's time to open their gifts. And Della comes, you know, she's got, "Where's your hair?" "Well, I sold it to buy you this gift." And she's kind of, "Where's your watch?" You know, "Well, I sold it to buy you this gift." You know, they'd each given up their most precious possession to express their love for the other. That's what she did. Devotion doesn't count the cost. And now we see that devotion also is not self-conscious. Now, look again at verse 3. It says near the end of the verse that she wiped his feet with her hair. Now, that sounds kind of weird to us. We totally don't get the significance of that because in that culture, a woman never let her hair down. A single woman was never seen with her hair down, ever, anywhere, by anyone. A married woman may be seen by her husband and her children in the privacy of their home. Other than that, that long hair always tied up under a hat or put away, you know, into a bun or whatever you call it. I don't know. But, you know, it just wasn't done. It would be, you know, for a woman to let her hair down in front of strangers, it would be the equivalent of walking around in your underwear. It's just not done. It kind of reminds me of my dad. My dad grew up in Mississippi in the late 20s, early 30s. And I'm telling you, except for one time at a swimming pool, I never saw my dad with his shirt off. You know, and maybe the t-shirt, maybe when he was on his way to get dressed or something. But that was just culturally, you know, that was a thing. Me, I'm walking around with my gut hanging out, answering the door. "Yeah, can I help you?" You know, but in that culture, it's just a whole different deal. And she's got her hair down. And see, it's not that she decided she didn't care what anybody thought, that kind of I don't give a rip attitude. She was so caught up in the moment, in the love and in the devotion, that she didn't stop to consider what was politically or socially correct. She just did what her heart told her to do. You know, when Mary and I first met, I don't want to gross anybody out, but we really liked to kiss. After we got to know each other a little bit, you know, like a couple hours in, I don't know. No, it was more than that, I'm kidding. I didn't see her for a week after I met her. But, you know, once we became kind of boyfriend and girlfriend, I just liked to kiss her a lot, and she didn't seem to mind, you know, and she didn't have to, like, I didn't have to grab her and hold her, you know. And so we got kind of, you know, she lived in Portland, I lived in Vancouver, I'd take the bus over there, it's two buses, it costs $1.35 at the time, one way, and you finally end up at her house, and then we'd take the bus and we'd go back downtown Portland and kind of just walk around, we didn't have any money to spend or anything, there were no Starbucks, you know, or anything that we were interested in except each other, and just every once in a while we'd be standing on the corner, whatever, 5th and Alder, 6th and Main, and I'd just grab her and lay one on her, because I wanted to. You know, because I like it. I like her. And that's kind of the idea here. You know, it's probably not socially acceptable, and I don't recommend it, young people, or anybody really for that matter. Don't go necking on the corner, you know. Don't go making out on the corner. But that idea of kind of, you know, did you ever think about the fact that that's just not cool to do? It's not that we thought about it and decided we didn't care. We just didn't think about it. Because we were just into each other, and the lips are hot, and you gotta, you know, you gotta go, you gotta kiss. And she just didn't care who saw her with her hair down. She didn't think about my hair's down. I'm break my dowry. You know, none of that stuff mattered to her. She just loved Jesus, and she was gonna do whatever her heart led her to do. We find out in a minute that whether she realizes it or not, this is a symbolic anointing for burial. Jesus realizes it. We'll read that in a minute. You know, there's a similar situation to this. It's not the same story, not the same people, it's not the same place, not the same woman, but a similar story in Luke chapter 7. Turn back there. It's just the book right before John, Luke chapter 7. Now, not the same woman, not the same house. Funny, I think both of these guys who own the house have the same name, but it's a common name of the day, so don't let that confuse you. In verse 36, near the end of the chapter. Oh, let me find it here. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to come eat with him, which is an unusual thing. Now, he didn't ask him to eat with him. Let me just fill in the blank here. He didn't say, wow, I'm just, you know, you got to come to my house. Because he wanted to trap him. He wanted to get him in a corner and get him to, you know, put him in a position where he couldn't get out of. Of course, that doesn't happen, never happened. So Jesus went to the Pharisee's house and took his place at the table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment. Same kind of idea. And standing behind him at his feet, which is when you're laying on your elbow with your feet sticking out the back, which was the traditional dinner table kind of a thing for them. She stands behind him, weeping. You know, she's overcome with emotion. She began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with ointment. So, kind of the same idea there. She violated every social taboo there was. First of all, she's a sinner. And she comes to the fair. She wasn't invited to the dinner. And who knows if, you know, what she had to do to kind of get through the front door, but she's coming in. The harlot, the sinner, is coming into the Pharisee, the self-righteous religious person's house. I mean, she doesn't care who sees it or what they think about it or anything like that. She's just going in there, you know. And she was so overwhelmed that the Lord was near that she just responded from her heart. And again, it's not so much that she didn't care about propriety. She just shot right past propriety and blessed the Lord the best way that she knew how. The response of the people back in John, it leads right to our last point. Now remember, devotion is expressed in many ways. It doesn't count the cost. It isn't self-conscious. In acts of devotion, nearly always, be criticized by those who just don't get who Jesus is. See, the degree of devotion in a person's life almost always corresponds directly to a person's understanding of just what a relationship with Jesus really means. Now, we were in Luke chapter 7. Let's just keep reading there in Luke 7, the rest of this story, because it proves this point out perfectly. We started in verse 36 of Luke 7. Let's continue in verse 39, Luke 7, 39. She wets his feet with her tears, anoints his feet with ointment. She wipes them with her feet. She's weeping. She's overwhelmed. She barges into the religious man's house where she knows she's not welcome. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him, not her, saw this, he said to himself, now note that, to himself, probably thought it to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who's touching him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answering said to him, now catch that. He said to himself, and Jesus answered, knew what he was thinking. Now that may or may not be a supernatural, you know, manifestation of Jesus' deity. Maybe he's just smart enough to see the guy's face and know what's going on upstairs. Simon, I have something to say to you. And he said, say it, teacher. Verse 41, a certain moneylender had two debtors. One owed him 500 denarii. Now remember, 300 denarii was a year's pay. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. And when they couldn't pay, he canceled the debt of both. Wow, that's pretty cool. Now, which of them will love him more? And Simon answered, well, the one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. And he said, that is, Jesus said to him, you have judged rightly. And then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house, but you gave me no water for my feet. But she's wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, and the kiss of, you know, the kiss on the cheek of greeting was just common courtesy, even strangers, you know, just like shaking hands. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she hasn't ceased to kiss my feet. You didn't anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. Why? Because she did these things? No. But because her heart towards him was such that it led her to do those things. For she loved much, but he who is forgiven little loves little. A greater awareness of sin leads to a greater appreciation of forgiveness. An honest understanding of man's hopeless condition leads to an inexpressible gratitude for the hope we have in Jesus. Now that's devotion. Gratitude that can't be spoken. There are no words. There is no language. It must be expressed outwardly somehow. But there will always be a wet blanket around, somebody who just doesn't get it. And most often, it's not that they can't get it. They won't get it. Goes back to what we learned a couple of chapters ago in John, none so blind as he who will not see. Here we are back in John 12 at verse 4. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, and he who was about to betray him, you know, looking back, John gives us this information, and he says, why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? Well, first of all, well, this is a minor point, but realize this is it's the first words of Judas ever recorded in the gospel. It's a week before the crucifixion, and Judas finally has something to say, and what is it? It's critical. And then John goes on to tell us he wasn't saying that because he cared about the poor. He said it because he was the money keeper and he used to help himself to what was in there. So this is what he has to say. Judas had a different agenda. And that will always be a problem. Followers of Jesus, you come to him with a different agenda, you're not going to get what you want. And unless you adjust your agenda to his, you're going to go away, if not a betrayer, at the very least disappointed. He wanted a political Messiah. And based on the expectations of the day, I mean, that wasn't unusual. That you, I guess the word reasonable might come into play just based on the culture and the common ideas of what the Messiah was going to look like and what he was going to do and all that. But, you know, Judas had this agenda. There was no devotion in his heart to Jesus as the Son of God. There was devotion to a potential political king. And with all this talk about, you know, in 3 days, or I'm going to go to Jerusalem and be arrested and murdered in 3 days, rise again, huh, what? That doesn't make sense to me. We need you to go in there and, you know, kick these guys out and take over the kingdom again. There was no devotion, really. Judas had this ulterior motive, you know, and he didn't appreciate her act of devotion because it didn't fit his agenda. He only saw what could have been his. So he not only criticized her, he criticized Jesus. Said this right out loud. You know, this stuff could have been sold for a small fortune, which I could have helped myself to a large portion of, you know, by the way. And Jesus said, leave her alone so that she may keep it. You know, that is, have the expensive, precious, pure nard, for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me. You know, Jesus seemed to recognize that this was kind of a precursor, a preview of his anointing for burial. And what's interesting is, as obviously devoted as Mary is, you'll notice that she's not mentioned among the women that are there on that first Easter morning who came to anoint the body. Now, maybe she was there and wasn't named. We don't know, you know, who all exactly was there. Although there's a lot of gals named by name. And, you know, there's Mary the mother of James, and there's Salome and so forth. But nothing about Mary, the sister of Martha, and Lazarus, the man who, you know, was risen from the dead. None of that. And the reason she wasn't there, I would say, was because she'd already anointed him. She didn't need to go back and do it again. She seems to be the one, remember from last week at Lazarus' funeral, she seemed to be the one, as compared to Martha, who kind of understood when he said, your brother will live. Martha thought he meant someday, you know, in the sweet by and by. And Mary seems to understand he means, oh, right here, right now, which is exactly what happened a few minutes later. Now, where Martha represented the work, you know, and Mary here obviously represents worship. I mean, how many times do the Psalms, for example, say that the worship of the saints is like a sweet-smelling aroma in the nostrils of the Lord, you know? Lazarus, on the other hand, Martha worked, Mary worshiped. Lazarus was a witness, again, following that Warren Wiersbe kind of alliteration. That's a lot of W's. Warren Wiersbe worked, worshipped, witness. Martha was taking care of the needs right now. You know, she was helping prepare the meal. Mary was preparing for the following week with this sort of pre-anointment act of devotion. Lazarus was sitting there, the living proof, the witness of who Jesus was. Jesus said, I am the resurrection of the life. Watch this. Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus, all tied up, you know, comes out. And the religious people who had already decided to kill Jesus because he was a threat to their religious authority and their political authority were so impressed that they decided to kill Lazarus too. Let's take them both out. Now, as you express your devotion to the Lord, you will be criticized for it. You mean you tithe? You actually take 10% of your increase and give it to the Lord's work at this church or that church or some other, you know, church or ministry deal? Yeah. Not only I tithe, but I also give gifts and offerings. Because until I reach that 10% mark, I haven't even started giving. I'm just, you know, I'm just doing what I have. But you can hardly pay your bills. Yeah, I know. Well, you could use that money for something else. Yeah, I could. And I don't have any trouble thinking of what that might be. Well, then why don't you? Because I just love to give to God. Because he's given me a reason to get up each morning. Because he's given my life meaning, purpose. He's given everything for me, and I want to give everything for him. And that's exactly what it boils down to. Why do people do it? Why did she use that expensive, precious, fragrant ointment, knowing that a couple hours later the smell would be gone and next time he took a bath, you know? Why do people come early, set up sound systems and make coffee and teach Sunday school and make, you know, give of themselves their time, their talent, their treasure? Why do they do it? It's because they understand what's been given for them. The blood of Jesus. They understand what's been given for them. They understand what's been given to them, that new life in Jesus. And they know what's in store for them, eternal life with Jesus. And when you know that, you can't help but express that with devotion. Anyway, every way, no matter what the cost, no matter how it looks, no matter what anybody thinks or says. Would you say that your life is a life of devotion as modeled in these verses? Remember, we're not talking about the worldly value assigned to your giving. You know, every gift given gladly is a blessing to God. But the gift that he really wants is you. Won't you give yourself to him this morning? Father, you can have just about everything else within our grasp. We'll give you some of our time, and we'll serve you with some of our talents, and we'll even pry our fingers loose from some of our money. But gosh, if we give you ourselves, that might change everything. And now we're on to something, huh, Father? You want to change us from the inside out. You want to transform us. You want us to be reborn. You want the old things to pass away and the new things to come. You want us to take off the old life and put on the new life. You want us to surrender how we define ourselves and how the world defines us, and you want us to embrace how you define us. Forgiven sinners, saints, children of the King without spot or blemish, beyond accusation, simply because we have trusted you with our lives. And as we continue in a short time of worship, Lord, I pray that even now you have captured each and every heart, every thought, taken captive, that we might just simply, during this short time of music, let your Spirit wash over us and drive these truths into the core of our being, the way a driving rain soaks into the dry ground. And whether we sing loud and long, and whether we sit or stand, whether we are on our knees or our faces, Lord, use this time to bring glory to yourself and to draw us nearer, always nearer.